It's the 6th of July 2012, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Was the joke about the Higgs boson walking into a bar being told repeatedly everywhere further proof of the quantum nature of our universe? Will human cyborg Kevin Warwick use his powers for good or evil? Did Greg Palast get it slightly wrong on last week's show? Are the chances of upper house reform more House of Cards than House of Lords? Why does the games industry need more women? And are bubbles the next big thing, or will all of the hype just go pop? But first, the usual begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then do head over to our website and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We're now paying the bandwidth bills directly for all the downloads, so all donations are greatly appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. So on with the show, and the big news this week is obviously the Higgs boson, in that we know it actually exists, which actually makes the Higgs even more verifiable and real than, say, George Osborne's competence. To find out the latest on the Higgs, Kash Farouk has been speaking to actual LHC Atlas Experiment physicist John Butterworth. I predict this interview will be interesting within 5 sigma levels of probability. Whatever that means.
Hi, John. Can you start by summarising the latest results from the experiment you work on, ATLAS? What's new? What's different?
Sure. So we've been taking data this year, slightly higher energy than last year, and we've analysed now more than twice as much data as we had last year. And we've been obviously looking for signs of the Higgs boson in that data. There are many ways the Higgs boson can show up. It decays very quickly, and it decays to a variety of things. And we've looked only in two channels for the new data. So we looked for it in Higgs to two photons or Higgs to four leptons. And so two electrons and two muons or that kind of thing. And they're the ones that have got really, they give you the best measurement of its mass if it's there. So we added those results to the results we had before, and we evaluated the significance of what we were seeing. If you remember, in December we had a sort of hint at the kind of nearly 3 sigma level that there was something there, and yeah, it popped up to 5 sigma, which is the threshold for declaring a discovery. It's a little bit of an arbitrary threshold, but it's clearly that something there. Yeah, so we've discovered something. We don't quite know what it is yet. It looks like the Higgs, as far as we can tell. It's certainly a boson. It's certainly neutral charge, which is what the Higgs should have, but there are various, some of the other decay modes really have to be measured, and we have to measure its properties now. But we've moved from searching now to studying and measuring. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and the CMS experiment found the same thing, really.
Yeah, in fact, they've done, in some ways, done better than us in that they've covered more of the possible decay modes as well. They had really beautiful results. And yeah, we found out today, really, for the first time, that what we're seeing look very much the same. So you've got two independent experiments, both of them basically giving you 5 sigma now, which is, you know, there's no doubt, beyond all reasonable doubt.
You've written recently about not wanting to hear any of the rumours flying around about the CMS results. Your recent Guardian blog post was titled "Higgs Rumours, Fun for You, Dangerous for Me." Can you briefly explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a reason that we don't gossip, or we try not to gossip across the experiments, because it's so easy to fool yourself. If you think you're right, you stop checking your results carefully. If you think you're wrong, you check it really carefully. And even being as honest as you can, it's still easy to fool yourself. So the best way of not fooling yourself by any bias is just not to listen to anything and just look at your own data. In fact, we even try to blind ourselves as far as possible to our own data. We try and optimize the analysis without looking at the actual bit of data we're going to use it on. Again, to try and stop us subconsciously biasing ourselves, because if you think you know what you're looking for, human beings are very clever at kidding themselves, and you end up only seeing what you expected to see if you're not careful. And that kind of undermines the whole point of the experiment. I mean, in the end, what we're seeing is so clear that that probably wasn't a danger, but if it was going to be on the margins of statistics, you would want to be very sure about that.
So can you now say that the Higgs boson exists, or not quite?
I think you can practically say a Higgs exists. As I say, I think we definitely got something new. There's no there's no caveats in that. I think there's a new boson there. Whether it's the standard model Higgs boson, we have to do more work. It's not, we need more data. It's not just it's not a matter of statistics. There's some of its properties we haven't even measured at all yet, and we need to study it. But we can say for sure there's something there, and it looks very much like the Higgs boson. As an experimentalist, actually, it's the for sure there's a new thing we've found is the exciting bit anyway. I mean, it's interesting now to see what it really is. Actually, I think we'd all rather like it if it wasn't quite exactly the standard model Higgs boson. It was something similar, but with a bit of extra new stuff in there that no one expected. But the main thing is there's something fundamentally qualitatively new in the data, and this is just fantastic.
So apart from collecting new data, what else is going to happen next?
So we carry on, towards the end of the year collecting data at the same beam energy and obviously analyze that. Then we shut down for 18 months to 2 years so that we can upgrade some of the magnets and the connectors in the machine and stuff in the accelerator. And then we'll come back at closer to what its original design energy was, which was twice the energy we ran at last year. So 14 TeV is the design energy. At the moment, we're running at 8 TeV. So that will give a huge boost to these other channels, discovering the other decay channels. In particular, we ought to see the Higgs boson decay to tau leptons and to pairs of B quarks. And we're using those channels to search for it now, and also the guys at the Tevatron are using the Higgs to BB. But when we get more energy, those should become clearer, and more data, of course, but also at a higher energy. Those should become easier to pick out from the backgrounds as well, and when we start seeing those, or if we start seeing those, then that will be telling us that whatever we have found doesn't only give mass to the W and the Z, which is kind of where we're seeing it at the moment, but it also gives mass to the quarks and the leptons, which is, of course, what it's there for as well. So that's quite a big step, I think, to see see it in the decay modes where it goes to leptons and quarks as well.
Okay, assuming after the next batch of data, the signal's stronger and it's absolutely you've confirmed where it is.
Mm-hmm.
What next for the LHC? You're not going to just switch it off. What else is going to be done?
No, that's right. I mean, the thing with the LHC is it's given us there's this kind of energy threshold in nature, which is where the weak and electromagnetic forces unify, and it's the Higgs that's doing that because it's to do with the mass of the force carriers is why they unify. What we've really got with the LHC is we've got access to this qualitatively new area of physics, new region of physics, where the Higgs boson lives. And it's kind of like we've landed on the shore of this country with this machine, and we've seen now the first really completely new species, in this living in this country, which is this boson we've got, which might be the Higgs. We need to see if there's other stuff there. We need to see if the Higgs behaves the way it should do, whether the other particles we know of behave the way we think they will in the presence of the Higgs, and whether the Higgs is alone or whether there's other new stuff up there. I mean, the puzzle as to the origin of mass and the Higgs boson, it was the first thing on our to-do list, if you like, with the LHC, but there are plenty of open questions in particle physics which this machine now has a chance of addressing.
I heard Brian Cox talking about, this was predicted 50 years ago, and I saw Peter Higgs was in the audience. He was getting quite emotional.
I can imagine, right? I mean, it's amazing. It's, also, Tom Kibble was in London, who was one of the other theorists involved in the development of this whole thing. And it was really nice to be talking to these people who were involved in these ideas so early on. And so many people have worked so hard to actually, first of all, show that this was an idea worth testing and then to test it. It's just amazing.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks a lot, Cash. Good to talk to you.
Now, if you've been listening over the past few weeks, you'll remember that we've featured some of the speakers who were at the recent British Humanist Association conference. Perhaps the most fascinating talk, though, was actually the first one, which was a presentation by Kevin Warwick, who's a professor of cybernetics at Reading University and the so-called world's first cyborg. The other day, he kindly agreed to speak to me about some of his absolutely amazing work, though I can't help but wonder if he was just using it as an opportunity to find out more about us puny humans before he leads the rise of the machines. But he is a truly fascinating and remarkable man, at least, so much as that he can be called a man rather than a machine. I started by asking him to tell us a bit more about the cybernetic implants he's had and why he calls himself a cyborg.
The first implant that I had was an RFID, which is just like an identification implant, was put in my left arm, And the computer in my building could then monitor where I was at different points because of this implant. And so it opened doors for me and switched on lights and said hello when I came through the door. I mean, from my own point of view, it was like my body and the building that I was in, the office, were one. It was one system. And clearly you can see possibilities with that for airports or in hospitals. If a person has an implant, that doors can open for them, or they get treatment, that you wouldn't necessarily need a doctor there, and so on, if the system knows what medication to give them. But I think I'm perhaps best known, the last implant that I had was what's now called a brain gate system. It was then called the Utah Array. This was 100 electrodes fired into my nervous system and linked my nervous system with the computer. So I investigated extrasensory input, like ultrasonics, like a bat sensing the world, which was really cool and great fun. Extending my nervous system over the internet, I went to New York. We plugged my nervous system into the internet, and I controlled a robot hand in England. And was also able to feel what the hand was feeling, even though I was on a different continent. And the final thing, the most exciting, my wife had electrodes pushed in her nervous system, and we linked our nervous systems together. This was, for me, that was the, you know, it was the best of all. It was most exciting. A basic telegraphic communication, nervous system to nervous system. And for me, again, it opens up thought communication for the future. But I think it's the one part people have difficulty understanding. What the hell are you to communication? We communicate okay and all that. So it was one of those things. It was great fun to do, and I felt it was a big thing science-wise, but then they get a lot of questions as to what it was all about.
There's so many absolutely fascinating things there. In the case of your wife, you say she's got the implant. Can I ask whose idea was that? Who approached that conversation first?
Well, I would like to say it was her. I mean, there might have been some suggestion, but it's difficult. She was very much part of everything from the word go, so she knew, with all the discussions over dinner and the drunken stupor of a Friday night when you're saying, oh, let's do this, let's do that. But she knew how important the communication part of the experiment was. And I think she felt, well, look, you're going to link your nervous system with somebody else. It does turn out it's quite an intimate thing to do. Having sex and stuff like that, that's one thing. But when you come to link your nervous system with somebody else, she did feel, so she pushed for it, but somebody had to do it. I think maybe she worried it would be an attractive 21-year-old woman, and she didn't like that idea. So
how does this actually work? I mean, what does it feel like to sense from someone else's neurons?
It's like anybody listening to this, they are picking up pressure waves on their ears. I know this sounds basic, but their brain is receiving electrical pulses, which it perfectly well understands as voices and sounds. The brain doesn't have a problem. It's not painful or if there's a problem, but the brain understands it all. And that's what happens. We took about 6 weeks to train my brain to understand the pulses. And then what was happening when my wife opened and closed her hand, every time she closed it, my brain received a pulse. So it was very, you can imagine, a sort of Morse code. It was very simple. But my brain understood it. That's my wife sending me signals.
Did it start out as like a sensation in your arm, because I understand that's where the chip was, and then later your brain figured out, oh no, that's actually my wife?
You got it spot on, yes. First of all, we grabbed hold of some nerve fibers that we got because of the implant, and for the sensory input we had to train my brain to recognize the pulses. And if you're pushing pulses onto nerve fibers, your brain initially, I don't recognize that at all, I've not seen those things at all. And we also weren't sure what magnitude of pulse, what frequency of pulse that the brain would be able to correlate with and understand. After a couple of weeks, I started to get some sort of recognition. And you're right, in the first instance, the sense my brain made of it was every pulse that went in, it felt like a charge, electric electric charge running up my index finger. It wasn't that. That wasn't what was happening, but that was the sense my brain made of every pulse. And that got us going. But then when we did other things, when I was linked up to my wife, for example, very clearly my brain thought that's my wife sending me signals. It didn't think of charges running up my finger or anything like that.
Can you envisage anything how this sort of technology could be used in more real-world applications?
Clearly, this technology has a big impact to help people with disabilities. And this is a major driving force. And the team that has been in competition with us, John Donahue's group at Brown University, they had put the same implant into the motor cortex of a paralyzed woman. And she was moving a robot arm around, and she had managed to get the arm to feed her and so on. Absolutely fantastic. But it was showing how the same implant enables people who are paralyzed or people that have different neurological problems that they can then control technology. Some of the things we did, providing sensory feedback as well, they haven't yet done that in the United States, but we've shown that that's quite possible. So with an implant in the right position, that's all possible. I think the communication side is interesting. This way we have of communicating with using our mouths and pressure waves. Oh, I mean, it is so out of the arc. You know, I mean, humans have been able to do this for eons, and we're in a technological world, and we really ought to be communicating with technology much more efficiently and effectively. So I do see this as a significant step in that way. Let's progress a little bit, please.
I understand also that bioethics plays a bit of a role in what you do and your thinking and so on. I was wondering, have you encountered any opposition to your research? Because obviously you're very enthusiastic about this sort of technology, but for instance, we've seen, the analogy I'm thinking of in my head is with the GM crops and so on, that's had sort of a backlash. Have you encountered anything similar yet?
And it really is very, very rare. I'm surprised it's not more often. Firstly, which GM didn't have, firstly, there is this aspect of therapy that we can look at a whole range of people, and the research is needed and the experimentation is needed in order to help them. Having people in a terrible situation, as you get with, say, Parkinson's disease, when it's not necessary, is terrible. And if anybody was to say, no, you shouldn't use these implants, well, you know, that they ought to be locked up, because it means there could be people really suffering pretty awfully that don't have to. They could have a much, much better life. When it comes to enhancement, I think people are now discussing it. About 10, 15 years ago, it was difficult to mention it, but now a lot of people are, hey, you know, this isn't a bad idea. Let's discuss it. Let's see. So I think it's more that stage of inquiry, and a lot of people have inquiring minds. So they're not against it, but they're not necessarily for it. They want to find out more. And I think it is down to scientists such as myself to find out more.
Could you perceive, or have you given any thought to perhaps a future where there's almost like an apartheid sort of divide between people who have these enhancements and are able to do things and people who don't?
Technology generally, if you think of cell phones or even telephone, television, it certainly stretches society. It gives abilities in different ways, communication and so on, to people that have the technology. I don't know that it takes away things from the people that don't. With this, though, it has a direct impact on intelligence. To be honest, I feel we are what we are as humans because of our intellectual abilities. And this technology gives us, you know, those that have the, even more of an edge, new ways of communication, new ways of sensing the world and so on. So I think it not only stretches society, but it could stretch it to the point where the elastic band breaks. It could well be that you need to have implants and links to the network and so on to have the intellectual abilities that are on offer. My own take on that is, well, you know, so be it. I just want to make sure I'm on the end with all the upgrades. I don't want to be down stuck, you know, not having that enhancement.
It's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks, James. Good talking to you, mate.
Now, if you were listening to last week's show, you'll also have heard my interview with the investigative journalist Greg Palast, who's written an explosive new book that makes many bold claims about how awful the so-called vulture capitalists are. Whilst I thought that Greg made some good points and illuminated some chilling stories, Drew Ray wasn't so sure. That's the annoying thing about being a committed rationalist and sceptic. If someone questions what they hear, then you have to pay attention and then draw evidence-based conclusions. So here's Drew's critique of some of Greg Palast's claims from last week. Personally, I'm glad we didn't interview Baroness Varzi, otherwise Drew might have exploded.
When someone suggests that a large event involving multiple people happened, but there is no evidence of that event happening, there are really only two explanations. Either there is a massive conspiracy to conceal the event, or, surprise, surprise, it didn't actually happen. Let's try an example. According to all of the available evidence, in September 2008, there was a gas leak near a central Azeri platform in the Caspian Sea. The platform in question has a set of wells used for something called gas reinjection. This involves pumping natural gas back into an oil field to maintain the pressure of the field so that the oil is easier to recover. The platform in the central Azeri has very little in common with the Meccano platform involved in the Deepwater Horizon accident. For starters, it wasn't an oil well, it was a gas reinjection well. Secondly, it wasn't a new well being dug, it was a well that had been operating for several years. Thirdly, it wasn't a deepwater well. While some of the Caspian Sea is considered deep, central Azeri is in about 120 metres of water, compared to well over 1,000 metres for Deepwater Horizon. As you might expect, the platform was evacuated just in case the gas leak ignited, and as you might expect, the event was reported in multiple press outlets at the time. Shortly afterwards, staff went back on board, and once the investigation was complete, production resumed. It's almost unheard of for internal investigations of non-fatal incidents to make it into the public domain. So we don't know what actually caused the leak, but we're not at all surprised that we don't know. That sort of information just isn't routinely released. One of the WikiLeaks cables even refers to the incident. There's no new information in this cable, but it does use the word blowout instead of leak, and it refers to mud being on the platform. This is third-hand hearsay, so it could be a diplomat mischaracterizing the technical detail, or there may have been reverse flow in the reinjection well, causing gas to come back out, bringing mud with it. There's certainly no hint in the cable that it was any sort of oil spill incident, similar to Deepwater Horizon. So, now we get to the conspiracy. Last week on the Pod Delusion, Greg Palast repeated allegations that he originally published in ecowatch.org. One of these allegations is that the USA press refuses to publish the other allegations.
I don't know why you're surprised that this shit gets covered up. It gets painted green by BP. Who controls this government? Who controls the media outlets?
The heart of the story is that Deepwater Horizon, according to Palast, was murder rather than an accident, because BP covered up the earlier incident.
By the way, I want to make that clear. Deepwater Horizon was not an accident. It was a homicide because they'd covered up the fact that they had a prior blowout,
which he claims was very similar to Deepwater Horizon. Specifically, Palast points to the type of cement used.
For the same reason, cheap crap cement, they continue to use the cheap crap cement, and in my book, that's homicide.
Elsewhere, he has implied that it is the quick-drying properties of the cement that are the problem, and implies that quick-drying is a property that goes along with cheap and crap. It is a matter of record that there were problems with the cement lining of the Macondo well drilled by Deepwater Horizon. Behaviour of the nitrogen foam cement at the high pressures of the deep water may have contributed to the accident, but only because tests showing problems with the cement were ignored. There is no reason to believe that a different type of well at a different depth and that it had been operating for some time is in any way evidence that nitrogen foam is generally unsafe to use. It is a commonly used type of cement. At the heart of Palast's story is a single anonymous witness with a story inconsistent with everything else we know about the two oil rigs. No other source that Palast found confirms any detail which is inconsistent with the official story reported at the time. Two explanations for this: a cover-up by BP or a blow-up by Greg Palast. To determine which is which, I remind Poddelusion listeners of what Palast said about BP involvement in the Azerbaijan coup.
And we thought, well, we get the denial. They never denied it. In fact, their words were to us at Channel 4. We recognize some of these statements as fact.
What BP actually said regarding Palast's source for the information, they said, whilst there were some of the facts in his statement that were accurate, we did not recognize most of it and regarded it as fantasy. Palast's omission of the fantasy explanation is, I think, rather telling. The Pod Delusion mainly relies on crowdsourcing for our fact-checking. This means that interviews and opinion pieces will occasionally be released without immediate, robust challenge to claims that cannot be substantiated. In presenting this report, I'm in no way criticising the original interview. If you have doubts about something said on the Pod Delusion, and you'd like a right of reply, or maybe just to get someone else to look into it, please let us know via the website. This is Drew Ray for the Pod Delusion.
Now, attempts to reform the House of Lords are rumbling on. Opponents of the proposed bill are concerned that it could end up in a housing crisis due to the lack of central London nursing homes for some of the million-year-old peers who could be kicked out. But is reform still a good thing, and how is the push for reform going? Here's Corey Hazelhurst, reviewing the latest proposals.
In August, I talked for the Pod Delusion about the Coalition's plans for House of Lords reform. Last week, the legislation which could put in place an elected second chamber was put before Parliament. Let nobody try and tell you that these proposals are unimportant. In a snide question to David Cameron at PMQs, Tory MP Bernard Jenkin asked which was more important, the saving of the European economy or House of Lords reform. This sort of thing is a false dichotomy which forgets the fact that governments can do two things at once. Lords reform is a key issue because not only is our economic system broken, but our political system is broken too. Trust in politicians is at an all-time low. Only 32% voted in May's local elections, a reflection of the fact that people just don't think politics matters to people's lives. The anger about the MP's expenses scandal highlighted the disconnect between the political class and ordinary voters. There is an enormous need to bring politics and power back to ordinary people. Democratising the House of Lords would be a small but necessary step towards achieving this. Opponents of Lords reform say that people just don't care about it, except that was exactly the same argument made by some MPs about granting the vote to women. When debating women's suffrage in Parliament, Harold Baker MP said that, and I quote, "The question is not the enfranchisement of any particular class, but the enfranchisement of politically inert masses who take no interest in politics and do not desire to do so," end of quote. And that all sounds scarily similar to arguments against an elected second chamber. It's practically impossible to justify the House of Lords in its current form. There is a simple principle that the people who make our laws should be accountable to us, the public, who have to abide by its laws. That's not the case with an unelected chamber. The Lords is also woefully unrepresentative of Britain as a whole. Of its 826 members, 78% of them are male, one third of them live in London and the South East. It's also an ageing chamber. 373 lords are raised over 70, whereas only 35 are raised under 50. About one-tenth of the lords, or 82 peers, are hereditary peers. That's right, in Britain we still have members of our parliament who can pass laws because their dad was a lord, or their granddad was a lord, and probably their great-granddad was a lord as well. These hereditary peers include Lord Trefgarne, who said in an interview this week, it's completely fair that he could sit in the Lords because, and I quote, the Almighty decided that I was to have a certain duty imposed upon me, end of quote. He did make it clear, though, that although he was granted by God the permission to sit in the Lords, that didn't mean he was better than other people. So that's all right, then. Although defenders of the current chamber will try and paint the Lords as a chamber of experts, soberly examining legislation, the reality is somewhat different. There are many peers who do nothing apart from collect their £300 daily allowance, which they get just for turning up. Research from Unlock Democracy has found that 75 peers didn't vote at all during 2011, although, to be fair, 9 of those 75 did pass away during the parliamentary session. 180 peers voted in less than one quarter of votes, and these 180 still claim expenses, of course, at a cost to the taxpayer of nearly £2 million. For instance, the Earl of Rosslyn was made a Lord after being a police commissioner. Last year he submitted no written questions, did not speak in the Lords, did not sit on the committee, and didn't vote at all, and yet still claimed £15,750 tax-free for being a Lord. Lord Truscott, who in 2009 claimed to a lobbyist he could change the law for a fee, claimed £44,100 last year, and only voted 19 times out of 131. That cost us £2,321 per vote. This is a monstrous waste of public money, but because it's in the House of Lords, people treat the issue as a trivial sideshow, rather than the scandal that it is. Reform of the Lords is therefore necessary in order to bring our democracy into the 20th century, never mind the 21st. Let's have a look at the proposals in a bit more detail then. Now, if general wisdom has it that a camel is a horse designed by a committee, the plans for the Lords are the camel of constitutional reform. The plans are a compromise between the Conservatives and Lib Dems, and therefore isn't ideal. But first, let's have a look at the composition of this new chamber. Instead of having 826 members, there'd be a reduction to 450. 360 of these would be elected, and the other 90, so 20%, would be crossbenchers appointed by an appointments commission on a non-party basis. This means there would still be a place in the new chamber for experts in various fields. There would also be 12 Church of England bishops, which I imagine might not be popular amongst Podillusion listeners, but it is a reduction from the current figure of 26. Elections for the 360 members would take place every 5 years, and begin in 2015. 120 peers would be elected in every 5-year block, so by 2025, the Lords would have its full quota of elected Lords. And these Lords would serve one-off terms in 15 years, which in my opinion is far too long. I'd rather the Lords had terms of 8 years and had to stand for re-election. These Lords would be elected under a regional list system, using an open list voting method. This is a change from the single transferable vote method of electing Lords, which was in the original proposals, and is significant because it puts more power in the parties, who write the list, than to the voters. However, under this system, voters would still be able to vote for individual candidates on the list, as well as for a particular party. The present legislation would also keep the supremacy of the House of Commons intact. The 1949 Parliament Act, which allows the Lords to delay bills for a maximum of 1 year, would be retained. The relationship between the two Houses of Parliament may well be clarified. There is talk that the Salisbury Convention might be put into law for the first time. This is an unwritten rule that Lords don't block proposals that are in the governing party's manifesto. The legislation is, inevitably, a bit of a fudge, but it is infinitely preferable to the present system. It's still unclear whether these proposals will become law. Around 100 Conservative backbenchers are threatening to rebel against this legislation, and Labour will support the plans, but are insisting they are ratified in a referendum. The battle for Lords Reform is by no means over, so watch this space. I'm tired of hearing that now is not the right time for House of Lords Reform. It wasn't the right time in 1911, when plans were first made to have an elected second chamber. It wasn't the right time in 1949, when the power of the Lords to block legislation was severely reduced. It wasn't the right time in 1968, when the unlikely combination of Enoch Powell and Michael Foot combined to block change. Nor was it the right time in 2007, the last of New Labour's efforts to introduce an elected second chamber. If now is not the right time, when will be? House of Lords reform should be supported now. We have waited long enough. This is Corey Hazelhurst, waiting impatiently for the Pod Delusion.
Now, also, if you heard last week's show, you'll remember that we talked about the awful Science, It's a Girl's Thing video, which showed women dancing around with makeup and shoes to try and encourage them to take up careers in science and technology. Well, this week, Kate Russell has kindly put together a report for us looking at what can actually be done to get more girls into science and technology rather than just patronise them, and in particular, focuses on the games industry. It's a damn good report coming up. I think that this Kate could go far. I wouldn't be surprised if we see her on telly someday. Here's Kate Russell.
Last week, I was as dumbfounded as the next person about the travesty that was the EU's Science It's a Girl Thing video, as reported by Belinda Palmer in the Pod Delusion episode 142. Dumbfounded, but not exactly surprised. A teenager of the 1980s, I've been fighting stereotypes of one kind or another since I first got hooked on a video game, Elite, and wanted to start messing around with computers. It was only about 30 or so years ago, but society was imbued with this medieval philosophy that boys got to study computers and technical drawing, whereas my subject choices were things like needlework and home economics. I left school with the ability to embroider my name on an apron and roll a mean Swiss roll, neither of which are skills I have ever used in life. But through the 90s and onwards, this attitude shifted, and games developers suddenly started realising they'd left half of their market untapped. The few of us that had managed to smash our way through the macho bullshit of the 80s and were already working in the games industry could only stare open-mouthed at the string of horribly gender-stereotypical titles involving fashion or puppies or ponies were unleashed to try and snag a bit more market share. And they probably did it too. In fact, I can imagine that those saccharine sweet titles attracted enough new gamers of a certain type to give the Games for Girls market rocket boosters. Suddenly, everybody was interested, and thankfully, some even started to make games that we might play. Luckily, today, mistakes like that EU campaign are becoming less common. But the real tragedy there is that that video, which went viral for all the wrong reasons, will no doubt be seen by many, many more pairs of eyes than will ever see a genuine campaign film. For example, take an event that's been going on in Rotherham this week. Games Britannia is part cultural festival, part art exhibition and part education conference. I was invited there to speak at the Because Girls Can Day, which far from being a gender-stereotyped day of pink, fluffy programming, was jammed full of workshops and discussions led by inspirational women and men who all make great role models for the young female techies of the future. I spoke to the man who's made it his mission to bring this festival free to schools from all over the country, Mark Hardesty.
The basic idea was being at school about a year and a half ago or maybe 18 months ago and seeing that we weren't doing anything with games at all in any of the curriculum subjects. And from my background, it was absolutely amazing that we were doing IT and all these other things where games could have gone in there and we weren't doing anything. So we sat about doing a week's worth of workshops and talks, and here we are now. So everything seems to have gone wrong somewhere.
Now, today is called Because Girls Can Day. Yeah. What do you think about the shortage of girls getting into both science and technology in education and then in careers?
This is a question I have absolutely no idea about, is why we did the day. I've done loads of programming workshops at school and found that girls are absolutely brilliant at programming, but then absolutely don't do anything at all when they leave school. They turn off and do something else, come back, and when we've done follow-up lessons, I ask if they've done anything again. No. And so I don't really know the answer to that. All I know is they're really good, really interested. I've got a daughter at 6 who's absolutely keen to do it. I wonder whether that's the start when we need to rethink and start pushing girls into that career at that point.
What do you think we need to do to attract more girls? Do you think we need to change science?
I don't know. I mean, again, this is a thing. We put on a girl's can-do day today, then you get criticised that we are stereotyping and just doing things for girls, and that's wrong because we shouldn't be segmenting girls and putting them over here and doing something else. And then everybody says that's a brilliant idea. So the pinking of things, you know, you yourself were interested in Elite, and that wouldn't have been marketed to a girl. We did loads of things with Fighting Fantasy yesterday, which girls really got and really loved, and that's predominantly targeted towards boys, but some girls get it. So I just think we need to do more of what we're thinking about doing now, but I think there's definitely a change at the top that needs to come. And I think just once the generations run, it's a long-term game. You know, this is a 10-year thing that we need to be going through now that Ian Livingstone started. You know, we're not going to change it overnight, but I think eventually, as you know, we've got Joe Twiss here today, who's CEO of UKE, and you know, you don't get any higher in UKE than Joe, really. So you know, that must be a drive, and she was formerly at Channel 4. So we, you know, women are getting there. It's just, I think we've got one or two trailblazers like yourself that need to be out there a little bit more, and I'm sure the change will come. And I can't wait to see some of the games that girls make, because my daughter has some weird ideas, but they obviously are going to work and appeal to people, you know. And I think there's still some pigeonholes. Girls like Sims, boys like Call of Duty, and that's you know, that's fine. They are going to be some stereotypes because they're all going to be that way. But there's somewhere in the middle ground. There's a girl that wants to play Call of Duty, and there's a girl that loves Angry Birds or whatever else. So I have no answers, but let's keep trying and try everything.
One of the key themes of the day's discussions was the current skills shortage in the UK games industry and how we can start breaking down those gender barriers even further so girls don't get put off choosing science as a career. I got to put this question to Joe Twist, Chief Executive of UKE, which is the trade body representing the games industry in the UK.
I think, for a start, the government has made some positive moves in terms of computer science and getting it onto the curriculum. We've been leading the cross-industry campaign on next-gen skills to tackle that. I think more does need to be done to encourage girls. There's lots of after-school clubs, lots of initiatives like Games Britannia that are trying to introduce girls into computer science. But it's all about role models at the end of the day. We run a STEMnet video games ambassador scheme. So we try and get people from the video games industry, because all children love video games, to go into schools and to evangelise about the industry and about the skills that you need, which are not just computer science, it's maths, physics, art, and all sorts of skills. So seeing people like you and seeing role models and seeing the possibilities is really important.
One of my bugbears in terms of getting girls into gaming and computer science is that people tend to sort of try and adapt the science to attract girls by making it pretty or pink.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with that kind of approach at all. You just need to make it engaging and interesting and find the hook for young people. All young people are different, whether they be girls or boys. A lot of the problem for girls is unfortunately the stereotypes that do kick in. So when you reach about, we found through research that Next Gen Skills, Nesta Report did last year, that actually it's fine up until the age of 13, 14. It's when you reach about 15, 16, those gender stereotypes and sort of the geekiness stereotype kicks in. But it's not about making it pink. It's about just finding what interests you as a person. And teachers have to be equipped to be able to find that hook. Games are a great hook for kids to be introduced to computer science. And there's so many different types of games. So it's not just about using, a shoot-em-up game in the classroom. It might be introducing, you know, concepts of code through a physical object or through a different type of game that you know a particular set of pupils is playing. You know, so it might be a game that lots of girls are playing. So it's about just finding that hook and finding what's relevant to them and to their lives and to the stories they want to tell and the things they want to do.
We're all here, technical women, you know, shouting about the fact that there should be more women in the games industry and in science in general. Does it really matter? How big an impact is that? Why should we be worried about that imbalance?
If you look at the games industry, it's actually 6%, 7% of developers, the people who actually code games, are women within the games industry. And the games industry is worth $3.3 billion in this country, faster growing globally than the film and the music industry. It's an economic issue. If half the workforce are women, and we're not even training enough people in computer science generally to feed the games industry, then if you do the maths, that means far fewer women are not being trained in computer science. So it's an economic problem. Our industries are going to require highly skilled workers across the board, not just in the games industry. We need people to be trained in these skill sets to affect everything. We also need people who are coming from diverse backgrounds. So the different perspectives that women can bring, that people of different socioeconomic backgrounds can bring, just people with different stories. Otherwise, you get the same products being coded and the same problems being solved. We need people who have different views and come from a different perspective. That's why it's important. It's economic and it's cultural.
As important as it is, though, we come back to the point I made earlier. I bet more people knew about the EU's appalling PR bungle than this great free education festival in the heart of the UK. The girls took part in the many creative coding and game designing workshops with real enthusiasm, and I got to speak to a couple of them about their experience. Bridget is 15 and interested in animation and character design, two of the things that really caught my attention at a similar age.
Well, yeah, it's still a little bit weird when you say, oh, I'm a computer programmer, but I am a girl as well. It does turn a few heads. But no, I think in the modern age, it's like, it's the new thing. People are going to cross jobs and everything, and it's going to come up occasionally. So we are allowed to do it. Now girls can, like, choose their own career path. Now we can do whatever we want to, so.
The younger girls were equally enthused about the day. But when I caught up with 12-year-old friends Lee and Nikki, who came to my workshop earlier, they were kind of more interested in beating their latest high scores in the replay exhibition, but they humoured my questions nonetheless.
What do you think of some of the older games? Do you think they're sort of quite funny?
Yeah, I think they're all good, but you can see how they're being developed.
We like the ones where you're killing them.
And are you going to study? Do you think you're going to go on and study sort of computer science and computer programming when you get into your later years and start talking about GCSEs?
If you asked me that this morning, I would have said no, but now I'll say maybe.
And was it today that helped you decide that?
Yeah.
So what was it about today?
That you just play the games and you think, oh, that would be easy, but then it's really fun making them.
What do you think needs to be done to make more girls like you be interested in taking this up?
I think, like, more exhibits like this and more talks, maybe like a TV programme about it that people could watch, like on one of the main, like, numbers, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4 on the TV.
Yeah, definitely. And then, because then they can see how fun it is and then they'll get interested in it.
So there it is, straight from the horse's mouth. You don't need to change anything about video gaming. You just need to make sure girls can get their hands on the hardware long enough to spark an interest. It happened to me, and I saw it happen to dozens of girls and boys at Games Britannia this week. The sad thing is, it might not happen next year, as sponsors need to see bums through doors to make it worth allocating marketing spend. If you can get along to the Magna Science Centre in Rotherham this weekend, the organisers could really use your support. Entry isn't free, but you do get to feast your inner geek on all the classic gaming consoles going back to the very beginning, thanks to the amazing team running the replay exhibition. I'm sure that James, being terribly efficient, will have linked the details in the show notes at poddelusion.com.
This has been Kate Russell saying all your bases are belong to us girls now for...
The Pod Delusion! Woo!
Finally, this weekend is your last chance to see the Royal Society's Summer Science Exhibition in London, in which scientists have come from all over the place to show off what they do. And it turns out that there's plenty of science left to do, even though that we're now done and dusted with the Higgs. I went down the other day and spoke to some of the people there, and surprisingly, the most brilliant exhibit was that of the National Physical Laboratory, who had a stand all about the sound of bubbles. I don't know about you, but my position on bubbles was previously neutral, but now I'm totally enthusiastic, as it sounds as though they could change the world. To find out more, I spoke to Dr. Gianluca Mamoli. So I'm here with Gianluca from the National Physical Laboratory, and you're here talking about bubbles.
Yes, that's what we study. That's what I got so amazed from when I was in my PhD that I decided to start studying them and how they affect our life. Because, you know, bubbles are really everywhere. Mm. But everywhere, in places that you would never imagine. They affect the taste of food, like ice cream, for instance. Well, everyone is knows about chocolate with bubbles. Mm. But there are cheese, for instance, has bubbles in it. And also bread, eventually. You put yeast in it to create bubbles and to make it rise. So a good bread has good bubbles in it. Mm. And so if you can control your bubbles, you can have, for instance, a different taste of food. Mm. And what we do here is we study the relationship between bubbles and sound. Did you know, James, that bubbles have a sound?
I didn't.
Well, the interesting part is that each bubble behaves like a bell. Mm. So a different size of bubbles creates a different sound. And to demonstrate that, we have built what we call a bubble organ. Let's go and play it.
Okay. So, just to describe this for our listeners, it is literally just like an organ. You've got the buttons to press to create the sounds, and then some tubes of water, which I guess act like organ pipes.
Yes, we have filled the tubes with water. They are about half a meter tall, and inside the water you can distinguish a nozzle, one of it in each tube. And just a bit above the nozzle, there is a sensor, so like a microphone, like the one I am talking into, which is used to detect the sound produced. Mm. So what we do then is we press one of the keys, and we get bubbles coming out from the nozzle. And these bubbles are the biggest one that we have. But then we move to the bubbles which are the smallest ones. And can you see that they have a different pitch? Mm. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Well, the fact is that they have smaller, so they have a different... they sound exactly as we said before, like a smaller bell, like the ones that you would use to call a waiter. Mm. But now we have a key which we call the concerto key. Let's go and listen to it. To me, this sounds like a bit like Darth Vader talking through the mask. But in reality, we have very, very small bubbles, a lot of them. And all of them produce this sound. Mm. Now, if you listen carefully to this sound, you might have heard it before when you walk along the seaside. The sound of the waves hitting the sand, 90% of that comes from bubbles which are formed and start doing oscillations and producing sound. Mm. So this fact that bubbles have sound is already used to measure, for instance, by some scientists, to measure the quality of exchange of oxygen with the sea, which is related eventually to climate change. But we want to use them to detect properties of the liquid. Now imagine that you could have one of those bubbles and change the liquid. What do you think will happen?
The pitch would change, presumably.
Yes, exactly. So imagine that you are monitoring the quality of your liquid. Mm. Say that you want to check the amount of insulin in the blood, or you want to check whether something is polluting your water. Then you can listen to the sound of the bubbles and detect that. Mm. So if we know so well interaction between sound and bubbles, we can eventually transform them into sensor. And this is what we want to do.
And the thing I was talking to one of your colleagues a moment ago is absolutely mind-blowing, is the medical applications for this. I mean, he was talking about how we could use bubbles to transmit cancer drugs and target them on the right part of the body.
Well, at the moment, bubbles are already used to help ultrasound detection of cancer. Some recent studies have demonstrated that the efficiency of ultrasound, which is normally 60%. So this means that a doctor which uses an ultrasound scan gets a 60% chance of getting the right diagnosis. Mm. So a doctor sends you to do another test. Well, using bubbles together with ultrasound, the efficiency can jump to 90%, 95%, depending on skill, the conditions, etc., etc. That's huge. Mm. That's really huge. So with just one exam, you can have an almost certain check of whether you are healthy or not. Mm. And what we are doing is we are trying to do the step forward. So as you were saying, we want to load. There is a lot of people all around the world which are studying ways to load drugs on bubbles and then bring them in place using something that we could call acoustic tweezers, mm. and then blast them or make them oscillate so that they can pinch the tissue and deliver the drug just there. Now, this is potentially extremely powerful because ultrasound is one of the few things which can affect the brain. So if we could use bubbles there, eventually we could be able to cure the most difficult cancers at the moment. So they are now already used for detection in prostate cancer, in breast cancer, in liver cancer. So the most difficult ones. Think what will happen if we could cure with small, tiny bubbles. And the other thing we could do is to use them to blast directly. So if we are not so successful in delivery, which is working in the lab very well, well, we can still use them to blast, to ablate, that's the technical word, the cancer. Nowadays in China, they are using sound, focused sound, high-intensity focused ultrasound, or HIFU for friends, to actually cook cancer cells. This is because cancer absorbs sound in a different way than the rest of the other tissues.
Okay.
But then this leaves you with something burnt there, that you want to get rid of. If you could use the bubbles, they could do also the cleaning bit. So not only the curing part or the blasting part, but also clean the room after the use.
It's unbelievable. I mean, how many years away are we from, would you care to speculate, or away from this in hospitals?
Well, the problem is a measurement problem. Because if you put something in the body, you want to make sure that it does not affect something that you don't want. So supposing that we or some of the other large community which is studying bubbles find a way to detect them when they are used, then they will start the clinical trials very soon. So it could be a maximum of 10 years.
Blimey, it's fascinating. We'll put links to find out more about bubbles and so on the website. John Luca, thank you very much.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do remember to check out our website, where you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook and all that sort of thing. And if you have enjoyed the show, please do consider subscribing and donating £5 or £10 a month, or making a one-off donation. We're now paying all of the server bills and the bandwidth costs directly, so all donations are hugely appreciated. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Cash Farouk, Drew Ray, Corey Hazelhurst, Kate Russell, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz Luckendorf and Drew Ray. The sketch in the moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Dottie, thank you for coming to see us.
Oh, hello. I don't often get to see the security offices here at CERN. Yes, Joyce cleans in here, you see. I mop down at the research labs. It's not even far to get to. If you climb inside the collider, you can skateboard round in about 3 minutes. It's much better than the Piccadilly line.
Yes, now then, Dottie, you were the only one around when this particle showed up. We're not sure which one it is. Do you think you can pick it out of our lineup?
Well, it was very dark, you see, officer. Are you sure these particles aren't going to be able to see from the other side of the glass?
All this paraphernalia has been built so we can get some answers. See that? Double-sided mirror. We can see in, but in there, all they can see is a reflection of life.
I don't mind telling you, officer. I didn't think I'd be back dealing with the scientific bits, you know. Not since the incident with Peter.
I'm sure Professor Higgs is past it by now, Dotty. It was a long time ago. Don't be concerned. Sorry.
45 years ago, since that fateful night. It wasn't an exclusive nightclub, but Peter hadn't dressed up, and we were turned away by the bouncers, you see. Yeah. Simply said, sorry, no trainers. Peter thought he said, neutrinos. Well, after that, he thought of little else.
Trainers? Adidas?
Adi what, dear?
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Oh, but it does matter, you see. Peter would say, matter maketh the man. Of course, he would also say, what do you mean, no trainers? I'm here to dance. But then he always did sweat the small stuff.
What? Oh, never mind. Look, just look in here. Tell me if you can make a positive identification.
Jesus!
If you've spotted him in there, Dotty, there's a lot of theories we'll need rewriting.
Right, well,
Look, take your time. It's really important we get this right.
Well, it...
Yes?
Well, it's definitely a Higgs boson. But the one I saw was smaller. And wearing a hat. Did I ever tell you Peter used to wear a hat?
Oh, this is going to be a long night.